Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 249 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast. That's right, we are only 751 behind Formula One. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man some call the motor generator unit that brings the heat, Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Robin. I did not malfunction in Bahrain.
This is very true, and something tells me we're going to talk about that. Today, in fact, we're going to talk about the Bahrain Grand Prix, which was the second round of the Formula One Championship, and then I'll spend some time talking about the Mercedes celebrating 125 years of being in motorsport, I suppose, participating in motorsport. It is Wednesday, April 10th, and here are the results of the Bahrain Grand Prix. It was Lewis Hamilton leading the way in the Mercedes, followed by his teammate Valtteri Bottas in the second Mercedes. Charles Leclerc, who was on pole, finished third in the Ferrari, the leading Ferrari. He was followed by Max Verstappen, who finished fourth in the leading Red Bull. Sebastian Vettel managed fifth in the second Ferrari, kind of reckoning it up there. Sixth place, Lando Norris in the McLaren. Very good result for McLaren. Seventh place, Kimi Raikkonen, still the best driver in the world, in the Alfa Romeo Racing Ferrari. Eighth place went to Pierre Gasly in the second Red Bull. Ninth place to Alexander Albon in the leading Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda. Tenth place, I should have said Honda for Max Verstappen in fourth as well, which is ahead of the McLaren and the Renault. I should have said that because Honda is ahead of Renault. I should point that out. 10th place was Sergio Perez in the Racing Point BWT Mercedes, which his dad owns. Antonio Giovinazzi in the second Alfa Romeo Racing Ferrari. 12th place was Daniel Kvyat in the second Scuderia Toro Rosso. 13th place, the lead Haas, Kevin Magnussen. 14th place, the second Racing Point Mercedes, Lance Stroll. And I misspoke. Lance Stroll's father owns Racing Point, not Sergio Perez. 15th went to George Russell in the leading Williams Mercedes. And 16th went to Robert Kubica in the second Williams Mercedes. And the last four drivers did not qualify. That was Nico Hülkenberg in the Renault, Daniel Ricciardo in the Renault. And Jesus, we have to talk about that too. Carlos Sainz in the McLaren and Romain Grosjean in the Haas Ferrari. So there they are.
They did qualify. They just didn't finish the race.
Yes, this is all true. Okay, so it really was, in a lot of ways, quite the race. And Chris, I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, it was a change of fortune for Ferrari, right? They struggled in Australia, off the pace. Most people were concerned. It was a surprise after testing. And they quite literally dominated. Well, at least one of their drivers literally dominated the weekend. He was out and out quickest, certainly through qualifying, and then through most of the race until he had a problem with his engine. And exactly, that's what all the Ferrari fans did.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And he lost power and lost the lead. So, yeah, quite a turnaround. They looks like they've opened up the engine, the taps on the engine a little bit. Mercedes were claiming that most of the deficit was coming on in the straights, which is interesting. And yeah. You wonder if there's a reliability issue there once they've opened them up, but we shall see.
It was fascinating. You're absolutely right. Charles Leclerc was dominating, but in qualifying, it was, in fact, Ferrari 1-2. Charles Leclerc leading that Ferrari 1-2. And it's worth saying he was leading it by better than 0.3 over his teammate, who is, quote-unquote, the lead driver at Ferrari. And then, so he had a few tenths clear on everybody. And then Sebastian Vettel was second with a 28.1. Leclerc had a 27.8. And Lewis Hamilton was right behind Sebastian Vettel with a 28.19 instead of a 28.16. So the Ferraris were 1-2, but it was clearly Leclerc's weekend all weekend until Sunday evening.
Well, especially when you consider what happened at the start. So Vettel got a blinding start, jumped off into the lead. Leclerc struggled, had a bit of a battle with the two Mercedes, made a good pass on Bottas to reclaim second. by this time, Vettel had a decent lead on him by a couple of seconds or so, which Leclerc very rapidly closed down and then just overtook him and drove off into the distance. So no Ferrari team orders, or at least he's not going to obey them. And
I think it's the latter.
Well, good for him. Good for him. And yeah, he showed a lot of promise. It's very reminiscent of the Daniel Ricciardo Sebastian Vettel season.
Well,
so far.
Yeah, no, definitely so. And the fact that this is Leclerc's second race in the top team, and he's already got that level of poise, is and should be very concerning for Sebastian Vettel. Maybe even more so than that mustache he's rocking these days. I think Vettel is a great person, and I think he is a really strong driver. But you know, he's really going to have to up his game. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. What fascinated me is Vettel had that fantastic start, and Leclerc was able to collect himself and eventually get back into the lead. That was extremely impressive. What is even more impressive is that Leclerc had an issue with his car at the end of the race. Vettel did not, and Leclerc still finished two places ahead. So before we get into the logistics of what actually happened with Leclerc's car and all that kind of stuff, just think about that at a high level for a moment.
Well, he was helped out a little bit by the safety car coming out, wasn't he? Because he probably would have lost at least the podium spot to Verstappen, and then maybe even Vettel would have caught him. So I think that's a little unfair, although I don't mind piling on Sebastian's case. I will say that Leclerc was helped out by the safety car. Otherwise, he probably would have lost, maybe lost out to his teammate. But yeah, I mean, before the safety car came out, you know, how far down the road was he? 20 seconds? It was a good chunk of time, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely so. And so you're absolutely right. The safety car saved him from losing the podium and possibly losing out to his teammate as well. But just with the problem that he had, you know, it still would have been nip and tuck whether he lost out or not.
Yeah, which is an extraordinary performance in your second race in a new team. And we only have to look at how some of the other drivers that are, in Daniel Ricciardo's case, well-established race-winning Grand Prix driver who's struggling to settle in the Renault team for sure.
Yeah.
And Pierre Gasly struggling to settle in Red Bull. And yet this guy's come in, he's in the top team, arguably one of the top teams, if not the top team, and with an illustrious four-time world champion teammate. And he's making it look really easy. It's impressive. And he's so calm and collected. And losing the win right at the death very well, PR on message, right? Didn't throw his toys out of the pram, didn't say anything daft, collected himself, said it was disappointing, but he'd move on, there'd be more opportunities, and definitely very mature.
Well, you know, we're skipping ahead just a little bit, but let's go back to it. So what happened was, it was between 15 and 10 laps to go, I think closer to 10, Leclerc just started losing 25 to 40 kilometers an hour straight line speed. And from what we could gather from the radio messages, it sounds like he lost his heat-based motor generator unit, which is the motor generator unit that's tied to the turbocharger. And that is the unit, is the primary for basically recharging the battery so he can actually use an additional 161 horsepower from the electric motor. So he's basically down 161 horsepower.
Yeah, but they've since clarified the failure was actually a fuel injection issue on one of the cylinders, right? So,
I did not see that.
Still significant, but he is going to use the same unit this weekend in China. So they managed to fix it. So he won't have gone through at least one or two of the powertrain component units. So they're only allowed three a season of each of those types of components. So that's good news for him. So he won't incur any penalty or go through a unit that may result in an earlier penalty. But you're right. I mean, the effect was significant in terms of his performance, and he was a bit of a sitting duck. And Lewis, who, you know, I know I give him a lot of credit most times, but it was an impressive drive from Lewis. I thought he, you know, was there and thereabouts in qualifying. He pushed hard throughout the race, made Vettel, well, he did a legitimate pass on Vettel that got him effectively, and, you know, he then spun, which put him well down the order due to Lewis's pressure in the pass. And, you know, he was keeping Leclerc honest, and he was in the right place at the right time when the Ferrari picked up an issue. So a fortunate win, but he did all the things right to put himself in a position to collect a fortunate win. And it was a bit of a reversal from the performance in Australia. So it was good. But Leclerc, you know, even though he had the engine trouble and he was on the radio and you know, was complaining a little bit, you know, he found a way, like all the great drivers do, to still maximise the performance, even with a you know, car that's not quite performing properly, and brought it home and ended up getting the podium. So great job.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I will give Ferrari some credit because that's the type of issue where a lot of teams would get very nervous and say, hey, just retire the car. We can't risk, you know, damaging something here. And, you know, that would have cost them a podium. And in addition to that, not just a podium, but it would have cost them a podium and a fastest lap, because Leclerc did get the fastest lap. So he did actually manage 16 points, not 15, for his third place finish. So you brought up Hamilton. Hamilton, I think, you know, Hamilton was also the cause of Vettel's troubles, though not to any fault of his own. Vettel, as you said, had a very legitimate pass on Vettel, and then Vettel nowhere near, they were a few feet apart from each other, and Vettel just spun it on his own, completely flat-spotted the tires, and then either directly or indirectly from there lost his front wing.
Yeah, a shocking mistake that was. I mean, after last year's trials and tribulations where he spun on three separate occasions while he was racing other drivers, has gone and done it as early as race two in 2019. And that's really, I think, more than anything, caused a lot of alarm amongst, you know, the pundits out there, saying that really that Vettel needed to clean his act up after last year, showing that he could crack under pressure. And, you know, it looks like it's happening again already. And if that's the case, then Ferrari won't support him. They will get behind the guy who's quick and seemingly unflustered. So, yeah, he's in a tricky spot right now.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's just been kind of a mighty downfall because, you know, he had Raikkonen, who obeyed team orders, and he was quicker than Raikkonen more than 50% of the time, but not that much more. But it was just Raikkonen always got second fiddle when it came to strategy. And now that he's with a young, very highly rated driver who is proving himself right away, and the pressure is immense. And you know, again, I have no ill will towards Vettel at all, but I am nervous for him right now because this is collecting to not be a good thing. And, you know, just as you say, the Tifosi is not going to have much patience for this.
I mean, what shocked me, I checked out the fastest lap times, and Leclerc's fastest lap was 1.5 seconds quicker than Vettel's.
Wow.
Shocking. Absolutely wow. Shocking.
Yeah, no, definitely so. I want to start going down the order, but first I want to give Lewis some extra credit this time around. Clearly he won the race and it was an excellent 1-2 for Mercedes and all that. But first thing Lewis did when he got out of the car was seek out Leclerc and give him comfort of like, hey man, you did a really good job. Clearly you've got talent. You've got a lot of race wins ahead of you. I mean, he was like he was like the comforting, supportive big brother, or almost a father figure to Leclerc. And that was so fascinating to me to see Hamilton playing that role of elder statesman in a way that I've never seen it so clearly than that before.
Yeah, it was nice to see. He may regret giving him that pep talk if he's fighting him for the championship in a few races' time, though. But I agree. I mean, he's it is weird to think of him as an elder statesman in F1, but it's true. He's been on the grid a long time now, and he's got 5 championships. So, no, it's a nice thing to see. I mean, I know Hamilton has his detractors, but the thing I've always liked about him is he's never shied away from competition. And he's always, you know, he has an iron belief in his own talent. And I think he's quite happy that another guy's come along that's driving as well as he is, and someone else to take on. And he's going to enjoy the challenge. And it's cool. It's very cool to see.
Yeah, yeah, definitely so.
He was handily quicker than Bottas this weekend. Now, I did read after the Grand Prix that Bottas got some, it looked like a plastic bag wrapped around his front wing at some point in the race. And that was one of the theories as to why he struggled for pace. But I think I think that must have happened quite late on, because I actually spotted it myself during the footage. And I don't remember seeing it, well, much of him, or certainly the bag on his front wing, until later on. So I'm wondering if it just hampered his sort of latter laps. Normal service was resumed at Mercedes for Bahrain anyway. We shall see what happens, and if Bottas can continue his strong Australian form.
Right. To be fair, Bottas finished a good 20 seconds ahead of Hamilton, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Bottas by the end was very comfortably ahead of Hamilton in Australia. So this was a reversal of fortune, certainly, but not so drastic of a reversal from Australia. I mean, it was, you know, I think Valtteri is already poised to have a much better season this year.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think there was a lot of people talking up, you know, that Australian performance until we realized that Hamilton's car had been damaged. Really talking him up, and maybe this is
true.
A little bit
his
of a reality
floor,
check.
His floor was damaged, that's right. So, well, there's definitely some truth that we shall see how that plays out. But, you know, I did want to make sure that Hamilton got some credit for that, because he did multiple times. You know, when he was interviewed by Martin Brundle and speaking to Leclerc himself, you know, it was full of praise for him. And so I thought that was definitely worth noting. Max Verstappen, he finished 4th in the Honda, because clearly Hondas are way more powerful than Renaults.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. The order, the results reflect that as being true. But I remember early on in the race, Carlos Sainz looking rather feisty and rather racy against his old buddy Verstappen.
This is very true.
He made a bit of a hash. I thought he could have been a bit more patient on the overtake, and he ended up damaging his own car by trying to force Verstappen off the road, who wasn't having any of it, and they ended up hitting each other, and so Sainz damaged his... he got punctured, didn't he? And so that basically killed his race, which was a shame, because up until that point, he'd looked like he could really fight for, you know, potentially 4th or 5th place.
Yeah, I think he got a puncture and it ended up damaging his front wing as well.
Okay.
Yeah, but... No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I have to say that through Lando Norris, McLaren has been looking quite good, in fact. You know, nothing against Carlos Sainz. But, you know, both in Australia and here, Lando has been showing quite well.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they both qualified in the top 10. Sainz was ahead of Norris this time, and I think Norris had quite a poor start. He was down a little bit, but managed to fight his way back up. He had a great battle with your buddy Raikkonen, and was able to hold him off to finish behind Vettel in, sixth place?
Sixth place, yep.
So, really good to see McLaren you know, coming back. I mean, you know, I think as much as we like to joke about it, it's good to see both Honda and McLaren making some progress, because I think the sport will be better off for those two being strong.
Completely agree. You're going to get a moment. You're going to get a moment of sincerity from me, and I completely agree.
I still think Honda's the worst engine, though. Maybe that's not true anymore.
if we can get Williams out of the doldrums, that would help even more.
Oh, Patrick Head's back. They'll be winning the championship next year, no?
Yeah, they just, you know, they just got to get that active suspension going. That's not banned anymore, right? We'll get to them in a minute. I do have to say, though, seriously, that, you know, Raikkonen has been doing quite well. You know, he's been in the top 10. He's been fighting. He's been doing well. He's been a little bit conservative with passes, but that's been true for a while. He's been comfortably ahead of his teammate for the first two Grand Prix. Now, that's not necessarily saying that much, but, you know, Giovinazzi had showed good form in the couple of Grand Prix he's had in years past. So it's not like he's a slouch, and obviously he's under the wing of Ferrari, and he's in the Sauber seat. It's kind of a warm-up to eventually get the big seat. So the fact that Raikkonen is performing as well as he is in a car that traditionally is very hot and cold, I think speaks volumes to his talent, legitimately.
I completely agree. I mean, there's a lot of people who question the move, you know, after being asked to leave Ferrari. Why would you at his age want to continue, especially in a car that hasn't been that great the last few seasons? And, you know, clearly the guy loves racing, particularly in Formula One, which is more than could be said for some other world champions out there. So, you know, he rolled the dice. He's been rewarded with a pretty decent car, and he's enjoying it, clearly, and he's making the most of it. You can't fault that performance. He was competitive in Australia. He did a great job in Bahrain, seventh place, racy. No, full credit to Kimi. Good on him. Let's hope he keeps going until he's at least 45, eh?
Yes, I agree. Let's talk about Williams for a second here. You were with me as well, and I was a big cheerleader for Robert Kubica coming back. Ah, man, two races in a row where he's struggling as much as he is. He's a lap behind everyone else. I'm really getting concerned here.
Oh, he was a lot better in Bahrain than Australia. He was right on Russell's pace, wasn't he, in quali? I think there was virtually nothing to split him. It was like a couple of thousandths of a second.
Was it? I knew it was close. Oh, it was 400ths.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, okay. I thought he was a few tenths behind, but I guess he pulled one out right at the end that got him quite close.
Yeah, and I think he was much more competitive. I think he had a problem with the Williams in Australia. I mean, he kept hitting stuff in Australia as well, so he may have been the cause of floor damage or something else that they never caught before the race. But yeah, he looked like he was much more on the pace. So I think we have to give Robert maybe a few more races before we conclude whether it was a good or bad thing him coming back. He certainly had a bad Australia, but he was much more competitive. But fair play to Russell. I mean, Russell, did you see? I mean, I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but we had post-Bahrain Grand Prix testing at the same venue.
And he led
Russell
in the Mercedes.
And was the quickest. So interesting that Mercedes should allow him an opportunity to sample their car, because you would have thought he might take some of that information back to Williams. And a great, you know, opportunity for him to showcase his talent. But I mean,
maybe Mercedes was showing some pity. I mean, you know, so the person that qualified 18th was Lance Stroll, and he did a 1:30.217. Okay, George Russell was 19th with a 1:31.759. So we're talking about a second and a half from the next slowest car.
Yeah, I mean, look, one thing that you need to keep in mind is that I think the level in Formula One is much, much higher and much more even than it has been in a long time. I mean, I remember back in the old days where they used to have, you know, more than 26 cars, and they used to have pre-qualifying. You remember that? And
I've read about it. I didn't see it myself, but yeah, I do know about it. You showed up on a Friday, and if you weren't to a high enough level, that was it.
Exactly. And they also introduced the 107% rule for a while. So if
I do know that one, because yeah. I know minorities were susceptible to it for a while.
Yeah.
And I think it was Super Aguri. They had to deal with that sometimes.
Yeah. So for those that don't remember that, if you weren't within 107% of the poll time, then you weren't allowed to race either. Right. You basically had to sit on the sidelines because you were deemed too slow. Now, they still report what the 107% time is, even to this day, and Williams are comfortably in it. So by, you know, a historical yardstick, they're not at the Lolas, Minardis, Super Aguri stage just
yet. But this is 9-time Constructors' Championship Williams we're talking about.
Look, I'm just trying to salvage any positivity out of their current performance.
Here's what I'll salvage out of it. First of all, the 107% time was 134.689. So, yes, you're right about that. But...
Well, they're way in it. 3 seconds in it, according to the road.
Yeah.
Great job, Williams. Yeah.
But the truth, I think, is the fact that they're doing this without a team principal, effectively, or a technical director, because Patty Lowe unceremoniously left that whole thing. It's just... it's just one thing after another. Yes, Patrick Head's back, but Patrick Head is not exactly the bright young star that can carry him forward in the next generation. So, you know, Williams is got a technical deficit that is going to take some time to heal no matter what happens. And so that's the coverage I'll get there. I still have nothing but love for Williams, but that's why it's so painful to see this happening the way it is.
Well, I think the situation's pretty dire. I mean, so what I read was that Head is back to look at the operational procedures, everything from how they run the car during a weekend to the whole design process and all the manufacturing arrangements, and to find where the problems are and to start to correct things. This isn't going to make the car any quicker anytime soon. That's for next year's car. That's for the 2020 car, sadly. And you're right. Until they, you know, figure out the weaknesses in their technical team and look at hiring a new, you know, team leader to replace Paddy, that's also going to suggest that they're not going to make any huge forward strides. And you know, you'd have to wonder who would go there. I mean, you know, Paddy, I think, didn't really need to go there. He'd had a huge run of success at Mercedes. He was originally, you know, he did originally work for Williams back in his earlier career. He probably thought a nice way to retire, go back and help my old team out. And maybe he just found that it was just too rotten, that, you know, the basic underinvestment, that you can't compete with the B teams that exist, like the Alfa Romeo and Haas of these worlds that basically buy, you know, ex-Ferrari cars and repaint them and put a couple of bits on to comply with the rules and off you go racing. That when you're trying to engineer your own car on a fraction of the budget with a fraction of the resources, that you're not actually going to be as quick as those teams, sadly, and that's the reality. So how they get out of this situation, there's no real quick fix to it, sadly. I mean, we've seen that at McLaren, right? McLaren have, I think, they're in a better situation, more resources, and they were awful last year, and only now are we starting to see, you know, shoots of positivity in their pace. So Williams are certainly much less well funded than the McLaren are.
That's absolutely true. I am still going to hold out hope, and we'll leave it at that for now. Okay, in terms of devastation for this particular Grand Prix, that award has to go to Renault.
Williams did finish ahead of Renault.
They did indeed, and they completed more laps with both cars. And Renault to have two independent failures of two different types on the same lap in the same corner. I mean, you can't write this stuff. That is absolutely the type of scripting in a Formula One movie that everyone would laugh out of the stage and say, that's ridiculous. But here we are in real life watching it happen.
Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary. Very strange situation. I mean, they'd looked moderately competitive up until that point, right? I mean, certainly Hülkenberg was going along reasonably well. Yeah, very odd. Well, the weirdest thing is that the other Renault-powered vehicles didn't seem to have the same trouble, right? So this just seems to afflict their own cars, which must be rather frustrating.
Yeah.
Weird. I mean, Renault and another team, you know, they went through a period of underinvestment. Renault bought them again and said that they need to put a lot of money in. It was a long-term project. But, of course, the whole time they've been making the power units, and for a long time in the hybrid turbo era, they haven't been on the pace. And you'd have to say, based on, you know, performance so far, that Honda have leapfrogged them, right? So they are now the worst power unit producer in Formula One, which is not really anything you're going after when you enter the sport. And they've had an amazing history, Renault. And you think about it, they introduced turbos to the sport. They dominated with various constructors at different times. I mean, they dominated with Williams in the 90s, right? And now here they are struggling to get two cars to the finish that aren't even competitive. That is not great either.
Yeah, and I just want you to take a second to reflect at what you just said. You just said that you don't think Honda builds the worst engine anymore. And I remember very distinctly how dreadful and how many years you thought it was going to be before Honda had any hope of being anywhere kind of competitive. And here we are, second race of the next season. You're like, well, clearly they have a better engine than Renault. So I just want to reflect on that for a moment and bask in it. Yes, this is nice.
But it's not. It doesn't really mean that they've succeeded at anything, does it? I mean, they still have only the third quickest engine. I still think they're going to struggle with reliability this season. The Red Bull is less competitive this season than last. Now, whether that's down to Honda or not, I don't think we can quite tell yet. But we all were looking forward to a three-way championship battle this season. A lot of people were tipping Verstappen to fight for the title. That doesn't look like a reality. And, you know, the lazy ones amongst us might just point the finger at Honda. I wouldn't obviously do that. But
yes, because you're too busy blaming Rosberg for some reason. That's fair. And I think the reliability question is definitely still there. But this is a little bit of a side, but I think it's a little early to count Red Bull out, because one thing I noticed about Red Bull is the second they have an opportunity, they are very headstrong to go after it, first of all. Second of all, so any amount of luck comes their way, they will absolutely capitalize. Second of all, Red Bull, I think, is the best developing team out there. They seem to be able to get time from their car faster than just about anybody. So if, let's say, Mercedes gains a second a lap over the course of the season, I wouldn't be surprised if Red Bull gains 1.2, 1.3. And, you know, Lord knows where Ferrari's going to go. They sometimes go forward, sometimes backwards. Who knows?
I mean, I think the other problem with the Red Bull is that they're fighting with just one driver, right? Gasly is not competitive. I mean, in this race, he finished in the top 10. He got eighth, but he was way off Verstappen's pace. So last year, you had the twin-prong attack with two very good drivers. That's not the case this year. So they seem to be a little bit further off the pace, and they only have one decent driver at the sharp end of the grid. So I think that's really going to hamper their efforts this year, although they may just focus all development behind Verstappen, and that might benefit him and make it more competitive. But I think it's looking like a two-horse race again. One thing that occurred to me, and I'm going to bring this thought up, but, you know, one of the things that fascinates me, you remember there was a time when all the young drivers in the sport seemed to be associated with Red Bull, and they seemed to have this never-ending pipeline of young, fresh talent to come up, and they were always swapping drivers in and out because, you know, this new guy that they wanted to put in. That seems to have ended, isn't it? I mean, Gasly, We thought he was good, but so far not proving to be so.
Let me just step in real quick. Uh-huh. It's only been two Grand Prix. Let's give him a few all Grand Prix to see if he can get his speed established. Okay,
I'll give you that. Yep, fair enough. But he's not setting the world on fire.
No, it hasn't been the best first two Grand Prix. Certainly.
They had to bring Kvyat back, right? Because, you know, who else were they going to put in the STR? And the driver they should have kept hold of, arguably, is Carlos Sainz, right? I mean, Sainz and Verstappen in the Red Bull would be feisty, I think. I don't know why they never progressed Sainz's career and they let him go. That was a mystery to me. They let him go to Renault, and now he's at McLaren.
Yeah. And, no, Sainz was right there with Verstappen. Sainz was keeping Verstappen honest. And, you know, now Verstappen is seen as this big megastar. And, you know, Sainz, you know, McLaren is not, obviously, McLaren is not what they used to be, but McLaren is still a well-funded team, just as you said. So, you know, there's still hope for him yet, but it's been more of a Nico Hülkenberg-esque career for Carlos Sainz than you know, straight to the top with a top team type of situation.
Yeah, and it just looks like a misstep in Red Bull's much-lauded driver development process, doesn't it?
Yeah,
really? You let one guy go who's clearly talented, and you've replaced him with inferior drivers, is how it looks to me at the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to argue with that. Okay, so the reason why... Oh, wait. Well, I should say that's the end of what we're going to talk about for Bahrain.
No. We have one rather significant thing to still talk about, I think.
Yeah. Okay. And I did want to mention one more thing, but you go first.
So F2, first weekend of the F2 season was held.
How is that significant? Okay. Go on.
Okay. Well, a certain Mick Schumacher raced in that race.
Oh, yes, of course.
And then he tested in the Ferrari in the subsequent test session at Bahrain. So I didn't see the first race, but he did come eighth in his first ever F2 race. He then, the way F2 works is that they run a second race and they reverse the top eight order, finishing order from the race one. So that meant he was on pole position for the second F2 race. And so I watched that to see how he got on. He ended up sixth, but he certainly didn't disgrace himself. You know, he was racing against guys who are in their second seasons of Formula 2. The cars are largely carryover. So those guys certainly have an advantage. And it was interesting. I mean, Michael was always competitive in the lower Formula, but nobody really knew he was going to be as good in Formula 1 as he was based on his lower Formula performance. So maybe the same will happen with Mick. But he certainly didn't, you know, he was competitive. He was there and thereabouts, but he didn't do anything extraordinary, really, was my summation of that race.
Right. But, well, no, that's fair. But, I mean, Mick has a huge disadvantage, which is he will always be compared against his father.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I mean, there's guys that finished fourth in the championship, I think it was, for... of course, I'm forgetting his name as well. For Alexander Albon, didn't he finish like fourth or fifth in the F2 championship? And he's in Formula One. So the fact that he's got Michael Schumacher's name attached to him, right now, that's an anchor.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, look, it wasn't a bad first weekend in Formula Two. I mean, a couple of people have pointed out that people like Verstappen didn't even do Formula Two, they skipped it, right? And went straight into F1. So Mick is sort of taking a slightly more cautious approach. But why not? I mean, I think it already sounds like he's quite methodical and very into the detail. So just like his dad, wanted to understand, you know, every aspect of how a race weekend functions and how he can maximize every aspect. It sounds like his son works exactly the same way. So that will be... how he becomes successful. He'll probably figure out F2 before too long and end up dominating it and then moving to F1. So hey, whatever works for him. I just was interested to see him race. It's cool. It's great to see a Schumacher name back in at the sort of sharper end of the sport. And it'd be fascinating to watch his progress.
Totally agree. And I just wanted to quickly say that it is still Valtteri Bottas as leading the championship with 44 points compared to Lewis Hamilton's 43. And that's because Valtteri Bottas did get the fastest lap in Australia and Lewis Hamilton did not, because Leclerc did. Max Verstappen is in third for Red Bull Racing Honda. He is ahead of Charles Leclerc, who is in fourth, 4 points clear of Sebastian Vettel in fifth. And Kimi Raikkonen is sixth in the championship right now. That's kind of nice.
And that's as far as you're going to go.
Well, I mean, hey, it's still nice. It's still nice for us old guys. Mercedes is clearly in front of the Constructors' Championship. Ferrari is in second. Red Bull third. And Kimi Raikkonen's position has put Red Bull Alfa Romeo Racing in fourth in the Constructors so far. McLaren's doing okay in fifth. Haas Ferrari in sixth. Renault in seventh. And I'm going to go down. 9 out of 10 teams have already scored points. Yeah, it is Williams that is the exception.
Hey, oh, Haas had a weird race, didn't they? They didn't finish in the top 10. They're struggling. They've had two dodgy races so far this season, even though their car's quick. Interesting to see how they get on.
Well, and Romain Grosjean, you know, he's proving consistent in his inconsistency. You know, he's just very hot and cold, and he seems to always find trouble, you know. So,
okay. Well, have you been watching the Netflix series?
I have not, no.
So there's been a recent Formula One Fly on the Wall documentary, and I guess Ferrari and Mercedes didn't play ball, so they're not featured in it. I don't have Netflix, but I've read a little bit about the series. The insights into the Haas team apparently are quite amusing, especially their reaction to Grosjean's calamities throughout last year. So I hope to watch it at some point. I can't remember. What's the name of their technical director? I can't think of it right now.
Gunter Steiner.
Gunter Steiner, apparently. His management skills have been likened to The Office's lead character's management skills. You don't really give them much support and keep throwing them under the bus every opportunity.
I do have Netflix, and maybe we'll have to have a binge watching party sometime.
Yeah, it does sound quite funny.
It's funny you mentioned Grosjean, because I'd like to shift gears and let's wrap up Formula One. All done. Bahrain, goodbye. I spoke with among the people that I got a chance to meet. I had a few minutes time with Esteban Gutierrez, who was Romain Grosjean's teammate for a year at Haas. And Gutierrez was very professional and mature about it, but definitely did hint at that. How do I say this? Romain Grosjean certainly was not his favorite person in the world.
How did he hint at that? What was his exact phrase?
He basically, I asked the questions and he had facial expressions. But it was essentially, it was like, what was the Haas Formula team? He was like, yeah, it was difficult at times. And yeah, I was like, okay, well, how much was that Romain? And he's like,
So he just didn't like the lettuce there, is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, it was, you know, it was pretty clear. I mean, Gutierrez, you know, I certainly think he had his own fair share of his woes in Formula One. I'm certainly not making him blameless, but at the same time, it's not like he's the only one that feels this way about Romain.
So who else did you get to talk to? Did you get to see anything interesting?
Yeah, so the Mercedes was celebrating 125 years of being in motorsport. So just think about that for a second. How many car companies have been around for 125 years?
Well, yeah, and what racing were they doing in 1895?
1894. Okay, it was this French race from Paris to Rouen or Racan or something like that. And it was a Daimler-Benz designed engine that was powering the cars, and that was their first. That was their first race. And I do believe they won. They do believe they won the race because the steam-powered car that actually won the race was disqualified later.
Was it a Honda?
Right. Yes, it was a steam-powered Honda, because the engines were supposed to be unassisted, and apparently the Stanley Steamer that had actually won had got way too much assistance.
So they won on a technicality in the two-car race.
Kind of sort of. Well, I don't know how many cars. I think it was a lot more than two cars entered.
Okay.
But anyway, 1894. That was not the thing that caught my eye the most. I was too busy wrapped up looking at all these epic sports cars that have been over the years. They had some cool top speed cars. Their early, mid-50s Formula One cars. And then some DTM cars that were there, rally cars, just, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of stuff just hanging out. And then 10 Formula One cars, 2010 through 2019, on display right there.
And this was
every year, every single one.
This was in Brackley, the F1 location in Brackley?
No, this was at Silverstone. So Mercedes rented out Silverstone.
Okay.
And had a big facility set up, and that had all these cars set up. And then they had, I got a few laps in GT3 car, GT4 car, the Mercedes DTM car, which was driven by Valtteri Bottas. So I shook Valtteri Bottas' hand and talked with him for a couple minutes. And that was incredible because I didn't know who it was. I was just kind of like, they were throwing me in the car, like, okay, go, go. I said, hi, my name's Rob. And he said, yeah, Valtteri. But I said, oh, wait, I'm sorry, who was your name? What's your name? He goes, Valtteri. I go, Valtteri Bottas, holy shit. So I just start, like, talking to him a mile a minute. And he's like, yeah, we got to go. So we go and we do the lap, and then I grab him and we talk for like 2 or 3 minutes afterwards before he gets whisked away somewhere else. And long story short, I gave him my condolences for what happened in Baku last year. I said, hey man, that was super shitty. I'm really sorry for that. And he said, yeah, thanks. And I asked him, I said, okay, what's different? What's different this year compared to the last? What did you do to train and all this kind of stuff? And he's a man of few words, I'll tell you. But he said, I trained not too terribly different, but mostly what's different is up here. And he pointed at his head saying it was a mental shift. And I said, I think at one point I asked him, I said, did you take any advice from Nico Rosberg? And he goes, no, I never talked with Nico. I said, okay.
Sensibly.
I said, but okay. I said, there's some similarities where, when 2016 Nico came back and he had a very different approach, and that's the year he won. And he said, yeah, there are some similarities. And so I basically said, yeah, it seems like maybe you're just going to be a little bit, looking out for yourself more, being more selfish. And I said, I don't mean selfish in the way that you're going to be shallow and selfish and that kind of, but just looking out for yourself better. And he said, basically, yeah, that's the mental shift that he has to look out for himself more on the team and not be too much of a team player.
So Nico couldn't give him any insight into how he managed to make Hamilton's McLaren really unreliable that season. He couldn't give him any pointers there. So,
well, Hamilton was in a Mercedes, but yes, he could not do that. And, but, I give credit for that. And there was I was talking with another team member of Mercedes Formula One. I made some joke about, like, how do you get Valtteri to talk? It feels like he says 10 words a year. And they had this little story about how, you don't hear it on the public radio, but they have this, like, radio conversation before the race going on where they're going through all the systems in the car and saying, okay, the strategy is to use this system this time, this system at that time, do this and do that, like going through like a, I don't know, like a 10-point checklist of all these different series to go through. And they say that Hamilton goes through the checklist and repeats it back, asks questions to make sure he has it right, and goes through and says, yep, okay, I'll do this, and then I'll do this, and then I'll do this, and I'll do this way or that way? That way, okay, I'll do this, and that, okay, good. And he said, they go through that same list with Valtteri, and he'll respond, copy. And that's the end of it. So I think that little story sums up Valtteri versus Lewis really well.
So you guys were running the Grand Prix track at Silverstone?
Well, the way they had it set up is it was not the Grand Prix track, I don't believe. It was kind of like this outer ring of the track. And then they had older cars running around what they called the Stowe circuit. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, yeah. So they can split it to a north. They have a national, international, and a south circuit. So the national is really Mickey Mouse. It basically takes woodcut cops and the old woodcut. That's all you get for the national. And the international adds like the Beckett's complex and the old straight. I can't remember what is it, Blenheim Straight or something like that. And then the South Circuit takes on Stowe and Club and where the new pits complex is. So they can run, I think, two circuits at the same time. So did they run any of the older machinery? Did they have like a pre-World War II?
I got a ride in a car whose name I can't even remember, which is pathetic, but it was a 1904 edition Mercedes that we were being ridden around in. And then Bernd Schneider, Mr. DTM, five-time DTM champion. And, by the way, he's the reason why I know about pre-qualifying, because he told me about how he'd get kicked out in pre-qualifying all the time when he was in Formula One.
Who was he running for then? I
don't know, but he ran Formula One in the late 80s.
Okay.
And anyway, Bernd Schneider, he gave me a lap in a Mercedes SSK, and that was super cool. I have a terrible video of it up on my Facebook page, which I think a few people have seen. But the video is dreadful, but the car was so cool. And Bernd Schneider, being who he is, we were going for it. I mean, he wasn't 10 tenths, but we were definitely moving the car around. And then there was another woman. Her name was, I think it was Ellen Luer. And she had a DTM career as well. And I got a ride from her in a 1980 Mercedes 500 SL rally car. And we were just going for it. We were drifting all over the place. It was a lot of fun.
Did they have any of the Sauber Mercedes sports
they
cars?
They did. Yep, nice. Yep. The Group C cars. They had a couple of those. And those were brilliant to look at. They had Bernd Schneider's 2006 Mercedes C-Class DTM car. That thing looked killer. They had Mika Hakkinen's 1998 championship-winning McLaren Mercedes there. That was gorgeous to look at. I really love those late 90s McLarens.
And what about any kart or Indy cars? They have any of those there?
They did. They had the 1994 Indianapolis 500-winning Penske Indy car.
The pushrod motor.
The pushrod car, exactly. Oh, right. Yeah, cool. And they started telling me that story, and I was like, dude, I know more about that than you guys do. I mean, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of super cool stuff there. And then before all this happened, you know, I got a tour of Brackley, Mercedes F1 factory.
Yeah, because they're pretty close. What are they, 10 miles apart or something like that?
Yeah, 15 minutes away, probably 10 miles or so. And, I mean, you know, so much Formula One is in that area, you know. You know better than I do, but, you know, nothing's that far from Silverstone, it seems. Sure. You know, see, I saw Toto Wolff's office. I saw the different parts. I saw autoclaves and all these different machining bits they did, and they had this room with like 30 a huge big computer monitor with 8 flat screen TVs that were all big, set up, put in a row, that had different points of data, and then like 30 chairs. Each chair had 3 computer screens and its own computer running. and each chair would be filled with someone that's kind of like lower level or even like grad school intern or something like that.
So they have like a live feed, either in cockpit feed or okay. Yeah,
they have a live feed and just, you know, some ridiculous number of gigabytes per second gets poured over of data and stuff like that. And they're like, I guess technically that what they see, they say is 0.3 seconds behind live.
Okay. Wow.
But that's 0.3 seconds no matter what track they are in the world, I guess.
Yeah.
So, and you know, just the level of refinement and the lightweight of every component and the cleanliness of everything, of course. I mean, it's just one, you know, it everything, you know, is just so closely looked after.
So they got their own wind tunnel there, right? Did you get to see the
tunnel? Oh, yeah, they do. But we didn't get to see the tunnel. And they're only allowed, apparently, they're only allowed to use 60% scale cars.
Yeah.
They have a full-size wind tunnel, but they're not allowed to use it.
And how about, so did you get to visit Brixworth as well?
Or they're not allowed, I think they're allowed to use the tunnel, but they're not allowed to use full-scale cars. They have to use a 60% scale car. I think that's the limit.
Okay.
No, did not go to Brixworth. Although I did definitely lean on Mercedes to one day let me go see Brixworth. So we'll see what I can pull off. But, you know.
So what do you think is the key? Because this is a team, right, that had quite a potted history. I mean, it started out as BAR Honda, right?
Right.
Then it became the Honda Works team. Yep. That became, obviously, Braun. That's when they had their first success. And then it became Mercedes. And now they've had this amazing run of success. I think this year, if they win the championship, they will have equaled or surpassed Ferrari's run from the early noughties with Michael, right? So they're on a real roll here. So what do you think is the secret sauce that makes them, you know, better than Ferrari in the last couple of seasons or Red Bull?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I think it's based on what I've seen, but also understanding that I have not seen any other team to compare it to.
Mm.
Based on what I've seen, I think it is, you know, death by 1,000 paper cuts for the other teams, because I think what Mercedes is they're very detail oriented in everything they do. And extremely well funded, so they can always be detail oriented in a performance. They never have to cut any corners at any level, it seems, you know. So I think it's those two things combined, and you know, they're in an upward swing. And plus, you know, you're right that I think it was the 17 cars definitely got a shift in rules. But generally speaking, the powertrain's been, it's 14 is when they started winning, and it's been powertrain's been pretty darn consistent since they've been winning the championships, and powertrain has been one of their big advantages. Mm. You know, no one's, you know, maybe Ferrari is caught up in terms of engine, but Mercedes has never lacked engine power.
Right. And they also, I mean, one of the things is that they've managed to find a good balance between outright performance and reliability, which in the three engine rule era is kind of important, right? There's no point in having the quickest motor and then having to replace it frequently. So I probably would agree with that assessment. But I think, you know, we all thought it was in the early days purely down to power, but they've demonstrated that they know how to build a pretty mean chassis as well. So, absolutely. You know, it's a well-rounded team, and they've
absolutely
done an amazing job. So that's great. Sounds a fascinating trip.
It's a bunch of Brits wearing T-shirts and shirts with three pointed stars on them. So credit to your homeland, sir. I actually have to say, I spent most of the time with a driver I haven't told you about yet. Mm. Stoffel Van Dorn is now a development driver for Mercedes. He does simulator work for Brackley, and he's also tied to their Formula E team. And Stoffel,
is that how the belts work in Formula E?
Hey, Stoffel Van Dorn and I had dinner together.
Oh, there you go.
And I actually recorded a 15-minute interview with him. So when I get a chance, I'll share that.
Was it waffles?
It was not waffles, sadly. Although I think he was also a little bummed that it wasn't waffles either. So.
Is he? I mean, he seems like a nice guy. I mean, I remember there was a good buyer in that one Amazon biopic on the McLaren disaster, and he came across as a really solid guy. You know, very, you know, heart in the right place. Big F1 fan. You know, quick in his own right before he met Fernando. And, yeah, so I imagine that was an interesting discussion. How's he coping life after F1?
He seems to be doing okay. You could definitely tell he would, you know, I started off pretty heavy-handed. I was like, so what was it like being Fernando's teammate? That must have sucked, huh? And that's not verbatim what I asked, but I mean, I jumped right into Fernando stuff. And that clearly was not his favorite talking point. Mm. But he didn't have anything. He was pretty disciplined about, he didn't really have anything negative to say about being Fernando's teammate. Because I led him totally. I said, you know, Fernando's got a reputation of not being a good teammate, not being a team player. And he's like, no, there, I don't have any specific circumstance with Fernando that was, you know, it was fine. But once we started talking about Formula E and some other racing stuff, and, you know, yeah, he was a gentleman. He was soft-spoken. We talked a little bit about Belgium so that, you know, we had a pleasant conversation. And, you know, I have a photo of Stoffel Vandoorne and I, because the lighting was so weird, it looks like that he and I joined the Blue Man Group together. So,
did you shave your head then?
No, I know that would have been the next step. It was a lot of fun, met a lot of really great people, talked with legends. Lewis Hamilton was also there Friday night, and I have a recording of him speaking about some things. But I didn't get a chance to speak with him. He was just part of this discussion Q&A that was led by Mercedes people. So no journalist talked to Lewis. He was just kind of part of that thing for a little while.
Wow, that's a bit prima donna-ish, isn't it?
Well, no, but it wasn't Lewis's decision. I mean, it was just what they had set up. Toto Wolff was there up there with Lewis, and then a few other drivers of note. You know, Bernd Schneider was up there. No, Bernd Schneider was part of a different group. But there were, like, you know, other older drivers with high recognition, especially in Germany. And there's a 50s F1 driver that's still alive. He's 91 years old now. And I think his name was, Lenz Lure, maybe? I don't, that's really terrible of me. He and Lewis were discussing about racing in two different eras and what that was like. And I thought Lewis had a really intelligent answer, because he was asked if he would have raced back in the 50s when the cars were so dangerous. And, you know, Lewis's answer was, yeah, well, I, you know, fundamentally I'm a race car driver, I'm competitive. And were I around back then, I wouldn't have known of any other way. I wouldn't have known of a safer future. So of course I would have raced, you know, that just would have been the reality at the time. And I thought that was a very intelligent, balanced, and elder statesman kind of statement to have. So,
I do find it fascinating, though, that, you know, Valtteri has to pound laps with journos like yourself, and answer all your questions about his beard and so forth, and yet Lewis gets to be totally handled and I guess that, you know, he's earned the right to be handled with velvet gloves, right? But
well, Valtteri's main job was, you know, they did some demonstration laps with what I believe was a 2015 Mercedes, so the W06 or W05. You'll forgive me for this. It was and he did some demonstration laps in a modern Formula One car, and, you know, did some did some donuts in it and things like that. And so that was his main role. But then he was happy to stick around, and he did some laps in that DTM car like I spoke of, and it was good.
But I'm surprised that Ocon wasn't doing that. I mean, he's their reserve driver, right? I mean, he's already one race in, getting ready for Bahrain. It's impressive that they had both of their mainline Grand Prix drivers there, and that Ocon wasn't doing that. Honestly,
well,
so that's good.
You know, as I said, Toto Wolff was there as well. So they had real, and this was the week in between. So
yeah, but they've all had to fly back from Australia after debrief and then get ready
this
for
was,
that.
So this was after Bahrain.
Oh,
China. Yeah, this was just a few days ago.
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. We're really behind.
But we are really behind because
I got this lucky opportunity. That's why the podcast is so behind.
Yeah. But you're still 6 hours away, right?
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, there'll be more to talk about there. Like I said, when I get a chance to, I will share the Stoffel Vandoorne interview with everyone, because, you know, that was super cool. I was just sitting right now. He just sat down next to me, you know, not because he chose to sit down next to me, but because he had to, but doesn't matter. I didn't know that I was going to, we all knew that Mercedes people were going to join us at the table. But I didn't know that Stoffel Vandoorne was going to be one of them. So that was a great opportunity for me.
And you recognized him, which is good.
Yes. Yes. I was happy for that part. It would have been awfully awkward if it was someone that's like, so who are you? Anyway, so, that's all we'll have to say about that for now. I do apologize that this podcast came out so late, but I do hope that you guys understand that this was an opportunity I could not pass up. There is the Chinese Grand Prix coming up in just a couple of days' time. It is April 14th.
Do you think it's the 1,000th F1 race?
It is indeed the 1,000th F1 race.
Oh, you're buying that, are you? Because it's not, but they're calling it anyway.
Well, I mean, listen, so many things are what they are by name only. They're calling it that, and so it is. I mean, you know, I'm sure... you being an engineer just like me are as aware as anyone that you can play some interesting tricks with math and somehow come up with numbers that you want to.
I guess they had to use a methodology, and so China's the thousands, but it gets rather complicated when you go back through the history of the sport and all the different series that were run under the F1 rules but didn't qualify for the F1 championship, and then when they ran F2 cars but they, you know, it was a Grand Prix so it counted as an F1 race. I mean, it gets a little bit convoluted, so I think this is where there's a few people nitpicking, but I find it quite amusing.
Yeah, well, and that's just it. They're calling it 1,000th. I'm happy to run with it, and that's the end of it, and that's going to happen in just a few days' time on April 14th. As is, same day, the Long Beach Grand Prix, that's the IndyCar race, and it is now the Acura Long Beach Grand Prix. Toyota was the title sponsor of that for almost 40 years, but now Acura is. That's the same day, April 14th. And then we still have a couple weeks for the World Endurance Championship race. That's the 6 hours of Spa on May 2nd. And then IMSA is actually going to run also on Long Beach, but the day before. That's April 13th, and that one's called the Bubba Burger Long Beach Grand Prix. Different title sponsor for IMSA and IndyCar, but there you have it. And I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars and check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, we did it again. I really appreciate you staying up late with me.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Interesting insights.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.